you want a vision of the future, Winston, imagine a boot stamping on a human face forever.
You want answers? I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
Someone is trying to teach me a lesson in futility. Why am I the only one who isn't killed?
They will run you dizzy. They will pile falsehood on top of falsehood until you can't tell a lie from the truth and you won't even want to. That's how the powerful keep their power. Don't you read the papers?
I just want to say one word to you. Just one word.
Yes, sir.
Are you listening?
Yes, sir, yeah.
Plastics.
I'm going to get your money for you. But if you don't get the President of the United States on that phone, you know what's going to happen to you?
What?
You're going to have to answer to the Coca-Cola company.
The world is a college of corporations, inexorably determined by the immutable bylaws of business. The world is a business, Mr. Beale. It has been since man crawled out of the slime.
Welcome to another episode of Our Interesting Times. It is my pleasure to have Dr. E. Michael Jones back on the show. Of course, Dr. Jones is the editor of Culture Wars magazine, culturewars.com, author of several books, The Slaughter of Cities, Barren Metal, A History of Capitalism as the Conflict Between Labor and Usury, the Jewish Revolutionary Spirit and Its Impact on World History, and I believe you're working on The History of Logos and The Logos of History. Is the working title? Right now,
yes.
As we speak? Okay. And I guess next year sometime, we should expect that?
It's taking shape quicker than I thought. I just did a chapter on Werner Heisenberg and Jewish science, which will appear in Culture Wars, in the January issue of Culture Wars. It's also going to be a chapter in the book.
Okay.
So it's coming together in a way that I didn't anticipate.
Oh, well, books tend to do that, right?
Yes. Yes. Thank God.
You discover them as you write them. That's true. Ah, okay. With your research and everything. And as events move along, too. So, well, tonight I had you back because I thought that given the time of season, Christmas season and all, that we could discuss, it's of course a historical issue, but it's also a contemporary issue, as these things usually are, the so-called Jewish question. And this was covered in a Catholic magazine back in the late 19th century, I think 1890, the fall of 1890, there's a series of three articles, the Jewish Question in Europe, the causes, the effects, the remedies. I read it. The first time I've actually read it, I've heard it referred to several times. I've seen quotes taken out of it, but I actually sat down and read it. I was taken aback by the tone. It's very different.
It's not Catholic Jewish dialogue, is it?
Very different. Not something that I'm used to. And if I'd read it, maybe 5-6 years ago, I think differently about it. But since then, I've read a lot of your books and given this question a lot of consideration myself. This was Civiltà Cattolica. Is that how you pronounce that?
Civiltà Cattolica.
Okay, it's Italian again. That was basically it's Catholic Civilization. It was a Jesuit magazine, if I recall, right?
Yes, created in the aftermath of the Revolution of 1848. because the Pope wanted to be able to comment on breaking events in European history at that time. Mm-hmm. And, this was the way to do it. It was a monthly magazine. That's what he did. And this is exactly in line with the intention that they had at the magazine's creation, to basically let's deal with the signs of the times. Let's interpret the signs of the times. And the main thing that needed to be interpreted in 1890 was the French Revolution. Mm-hmm. It was the 100th anniversary of the French Revolution. And so what have we gained from the French Revolution? What benefits have accrued to Europe because of the French Revolution?
Now, I read it. It sounded, well, I know they're taught. He's, yeah, of course, these articles are, this is a 1890, just 10 years before the turn of the 20th century, but it proved to be rather prescient in some of its warnings and at least its critiques and of Jewish power and its effect on then Christian civilization, Western civilization. But as events moved along, the warnings again proved accurate. Correct?
Yeah, they said, summing up the whole thing, any country that turns its back on the laws that were created by a Christian king is going to end up being ruled by Jews. Now, if there's ever a prescient statement, that is it. Think of the United States. Think of the history of the United States in the 20th century. From the Jews coming from the Pale of the Settlement and being rag pickers on the Lower East Side to now basically determining the parameters of discourse and what we're allowed to say and what we're not allowed to say. That's a staggering accomplishment or a staggering fall in terms of civilization, but it happened in our country. So yeah, it was prescient.
Now, the article, one of the first points they bring up in this article is just sort of the nature of the Jewish people, the sort of the fact that they are rootless, cosmopolitan, they're an alien people in a host nation. And again, this is why I was taken back by the tone, because here we are in the second decade of the 21st century. Of course, the lesson of the 20th century is that Jews are always victims, the victims of racism or fascism or just anti-Semitism, irrational anti-Semitism. But they take a different line on this. At least they look at the dialectic, at least, that there's two sides of the story. You want to elaborate on that?
Yeah. The main cause of first of all, let's clear up the term. Anti-Semitism is a racial ideology. No one in the church ever espoused this ideology. It was pagan. It was antithetical to church teaching. But, I mean, if you want to use it as the term for being anti-Jewish, the cause of anti-Semitism is Jewish behavior.
And the article actually makes that distinction. It says, I believe in the early article, it says, we're not talking about Semitism. We're talking about, it's not a Semite issue. It's a Jewish question.
That's right. Yeah. And they were very clear on that.
Yeah.
And the Jews throughout the 20th century have done their best to obscure this distinction because they like to smear everybody with the Nazi brush. Okay, the Nazis were anti-Semites. They got the idea from Wilhelm Marr. They were anti-Semites. They did feel that there was a biological determinism in the Jewish DNA that made them act the way they did. The church never espoused that. But the Jews love it because they can, anybody they don't like can say, well, he's a Nazi. And they do that by using the word anti-Semitism. So they've completely shut down any discussion of Jewish behavior.
And I'm sorry. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Until now.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay. and the article, again, this is something that I know as a myself, a post-Vatican II Catholic, didn't really hear of to recently, just some understanding of it, was they take on issues like the Talmud in this piece.
I mean, let's take a step back here and look at the big picture. Is there any continuity between that Civil Catholica series of articles in 1890 and the position of the church today on the Jews? Is there any continuity here?
No, all I hear now is confusion and contradiction.
I don't see how there's any continuity possible here. The situation now is a complete mess, a complete mess. I went to Rome a couple of years back, and I met with somebody in the Department of State, and I said, the church is not proclaiming the gospel here. It's not proclaiming the gospel. And this is Pope Francis had just come in. The guy kind of rolled his eyes. He was a Mexican. He rolled his eyes, and he said, well, let's go talk about something else now, because that's not going to happen. You know, that's not going to happen. I have a Jewish friend, okay, and he is the man. It was a Jew. This Jew paid for that translation that you read, okay, from Italian into English, okay? He agrees with everything that the church said in the Civiltà Cattolica series. Agrees with everything. He thinks it's the most profound statement on the Jews he's ever read. Okay? And I tried to get him in. I did get him into the Vatican. I tried to get him to talk to people, and it didn't work. But part of the problem was the approach he took, which I urged him, you know, keep focused here. Just talk about the Jewish issue. Okay, don't talk about anything else. Just talk about the Jewish issue, because you're a Jew, and it'll have more force coming from someone like you. Well, he got off into a lot of different stuff, and it didn't work out. But, I mean, the point I'm trying to make here is that there are Jews out there who think that this makes a lot of sense. He told me personally that passage where, you know, the Jews are digging a ditch, and the deeper they dig it, the harder they're going to fall, and it's going to be – that was prophetic. Because they did. This was 1890. A couple of years later, they did have a big problem in Germany. So it was prophetic, and the Jew who paid for the translation is worried that what's coming around the bend and what is just over the horizon may be even worse than what happened in Germany in the 1930s. Mm-hmm. So that's because no one seems to have learned the lesson here. And the one institution that apparently hasn't learned the lesson at all is the Catholic Church. The Catholic Church is the main obstacle to the consciousness that we are talking about right now, the consciousness of the Jewish question in the world, in Europe, and especially in Germany. I just got back from in October. I gave a talk in Bavaria, and then I spent a couple of days hiking in the mountains with a German friend, and it was as like the dam burst while I was there. This kind of psychic dam that this German had been living with, internalized in his mind, just burst, and he started talking about the Jewish question. Now, he's not the only German who's thinking that way, okay? It's gotten to the point where this man feels, that the Jews are now involved in their own final solution to Germany, and it's going to be through immigration. Unrestricted immigration is going to flood Germany with alien peoples, a lot of them Muslims, and the Muslims are now going to act, according to rabbis as he's quoting, as the scourge of God. This is going to be the Europe's punishment for treating the Jews so badly throughout history. This is a type of discussion that I had in Bavaria. Now, I go way back in Germany. I taught there 45 years ago, and believe me, no one was talking this way in Germany 45 years ago. No one was talking this way 20 years ago. No one was talking this way 5 years ago, but they're talking this way now. And the main obstacle here to a constructive dialogue on this issue is the Catholic Church, especially the Catholic Church in Germany. It's just a catastrophe. It's a disaster, because as Civiltà Cattolica said, and also as Pope Benedict's great uncle Georg Ratzinger said, if the church doesn't take control of this and create some type of peaceful solution, there's going to be a violent solution. That's what Georg Ratzinger said. His book came out, Jüdisches Erwerbsleben. It's never been translated into English. His book came out right within a year or two of the Civiltà Cattolica series, because everyone was talking about the Jewish question in the 1890s in Europe.
In the piece here addresses things like Well, one thing it addresses the fact that the Jews they may live in a country, but they're never part of that country. They're a separate people, a separate nation, so to speak. So this represents a problem in their relationships to the host country. But they have no loyalty. I think there's a quote here they use from Bismarck that God created the Hebrew in order to serve those who need spies.
Yeah.
So we have this issue today with, of course, the dual citizenship and so many people who claim.
I was going to chastise you for raising the canard of dual loyalties or divided loyalties.
it'd be an improvement, right?
The word canard is the favorite word out of the ADL, the Anti-Defamation League, whenever someone utters the truth about the Jews. And this was certainly, as you said, here's the Catholic Church quoting Bismarck. I mean, they're not exactly bosom buddies.
No.
And they both came to the same conclusion. So, yeah.
This article then, this is written 1890, so it's roughly, 600 years after the Vatican discovered the Talmud?
Yeah.
Yeah, so they're finally addressing it, and, it's... the idea that the Jews come in and they inveigle themselves, the control they can network, and then they can take over the reins of power. The article addresses things like powers in journalism and finance and banking and these things, which again, these are similar problems or that we see today. And this is this is way back in 1890.
Yeah, you're referring to the canard of the Jewish control of the media here. And the canard of Jewish control of finance. I mean, this thing is so full of canards. I mean, it's like canard heaven here. But it's the official journal of the Catholic Church.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what happened? What happened here? I'm still trying to figure this out. Part of, as one clue about what happened, to show you how contemporary this is, Pope Emeritus Benedict just can't stop being the German professor, and he wrote an article which appeared in Communio about the Jews.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one of the most tortured pieces of writing I have ever read in my life, where what are you trying to say? And the point he's trying to say is that there's no mission to the Jews. But what does that mean? Does that mean we don't want Jews to convert? No, that's not it. Well, what do you mean? I mean, do we want the Jews to go to hell? Is that the point? Is that the point of this? Because we have these two pillars here, these two principles. And we're trying to square the circle. This is not just Ratzinger. This is the Vatican issued a statement evaluating 50 years of Catholic-Jewish dialogue. And the two principles, Ratzinger articulates it in his article, and they in their little booklet. Principle number one, the Jewish covenant is eternally valid. Okay, where did that come from? Well, Ratzinger announces in the article, it's not Nostra Aetate. As a matter of fact, it was announced in 1980, which is about 20 years after Nostra Aetate, by Pope John Paul II at the synagogue in Mainz. And on top of that, he never specified which covenant he was talking about.
Mm-hmm.
So there's an Abrahamic covenant, there's a Noahide covenant, and there's a Mosaic covenant. So which one are you talking about? Well, the Abrahamic covenant covers everyone. It's not just the Jews. And so that's okay. I can understand that that's valid. Okay. But which one are you talking about? Well, we don't know. He never said. Now, that's the one side of the thing. The other side of this equation is baptism is necessary for salvation. Now, how do you square those two things? Well, the Vatican Commission struggled long and hard. And at the end, they said, we don't know. We can't reconcile these two statements. Oh, okay. Well, thank you. And then Ratzinger does pretty much the same thing. You cannot reconcile these things. They cannot, they are not coherent. And so one or the other has to go. Now, the notion that baptism is necessary for salvation goes back to the words of Jesus Christ. Okay? The other statement, which is vague to begin with, goes back to 1980. So it seems to me it's pretty unequal here. Why are you trying to balance these two things? Why are you trying to manipulate this? And I think in order to answer that question, we have to go to the tortured German soul, because this is a German issue that has been inflicted on the entire Catholic Church, largely through Vatican II. The Germans have the reputation of being the smartest guys in the room. Whatever room you're in, the Germans are always the smartest guys, especially if you're a German theologian. And they enhance that reputation by simply taking over Vatican II and turning it into their council, which meant that we now have been inflicted with this German understanding of what happened during and before World War II. And the clue that Ratzinger is still part of this mindset is the article I just mentioned. The first two words of the article are Seit Auschwitz, since Auschwitz. So in other words, Auschwitz has now become the determining factor, the factor which determines the outcome of Catholic theology. This is not a good sign. This is not going to work. The shelf life has expired for this experiment. We need to chuck the whole thing, according to the evidence they have provided.
So, the difference between 1890 and 1980 and even today is, of course, the intervening wars, the First World War and the Second World War, which, although allegedly during the war there was an attempt to destroy European Jewry, actually empowered it, because namely it led to the creation of the Jewish state in Israel, but also sort of the financial and also moral extortion, not only of Germany, but the entire Western world to Jewish power.
Right, right.
And it continues. Yeah.
When did you, as my 20-year-old white guy friends say, when did you get red-pilled on this? That's a reference to the Matrix. I prefer Plato's allegory of the cave, but yeah. Hey, so that's the word they use. I got red-tilled on this. In other words, I became conscious of the Jewish question in 2003 with the Iraq War. At this point, I just realized, wait a minute, these people have taken over the government. There's no reason to go to war. They're lying, and yet they want it done, and it happened. They have complete control of our foreign policy. Mm-hmm. And at that point, that's when I started doing the research for the Jewish revolutionary spirit.
Yeah, yes. Of course, this article, the Jewish Questions article in this magazine, 1890, did talk about the power of Jewish finance, controlling the media and the leverage it has. And of course, we see that today with figures like Sheldon Adelson or Singer, or who's the other guy?
Bernard Marcus.
Bernard Marcus, more or less controlling U.S. foreign policy.
Yeah, I said this in Mashhad. I've said it before, but when I was in Mashhad in Iran in May, I said there are three reasons why we don't have an Iran deal, a nuclear deal anymore. Sheldon Adelson, Bernard Marcus, and Paul Singer. Three rich Jews have total control over our foreign policy. Same thing with the Jerusalem, the moving the capital of Jerusalem. Same thing. Donald Trump, in some deluded way, thinks the Jews are going to save him. These three rich Jews are going to save him from the deep state's decision to destroy him. Well, good luck, Donald. But that's the reason. It's intolerable. And if you bring it up, you're an anti-Semite.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And the article also raises the idea, or it raises the question or issue, rather, of the aversion of Judaism by Christians. And P. Ratzaban, a Jew by birth who converted and becoming a fervent servant of Christ, deduced from the persecution of Jews that occurred in every age and place, the evil of the Jews is that they don't want to open their eyes in order to recognize the true cause of their persecution carried out in all the centuries without peer in history. Throughout the centuries, many people were persecuted by others. These tortures, however, came to an end. However, the persecution of the Jews is marked by its perpetuity and universality. Thus, it is a unique case which cannot be humanly explained.
No, that's why we need to go to scripture.
Mm-hmm.
And a passage like the Jews are the people who killed Christ and they are enemies of the entire human race. That was St. Paul. Wasn't it Adolf Hitler who said that? It was St. Paul who said that. And it's in 1 Thessalonians 2. And that, if you ever needed empirical proof, look at the state of Israel. If you ever want to give a speech in any place in the world and you want to get the audience on your side, begin by attacking Israel. And everyone will be on your side immediately because they are enemies of the entire human race.
Except the U.S. Congress.
Which is Israeli occupied territory.
You won't get 29 standing ovations with a speech like that.
It's actually more and more people are talking about it. And the whole point of what I've been doing here for 10 years is to provide some type of viable, peaceful solution to the conflicts that's coming.
Mm-hmm.
It's inevitable. It's coming. Now, I said this in the wake of the Pittsburgh synagogue shootings.
Mm-hmm.
I did a YouTube video with Peter, and I said, what have I been saying for 10 years? I wrote this book, The Jewish Revolutionary Spirit. It's a history of 2,000 years. I've been preaching the Catholic position, which is known as Sicut Judaeus Non. It was a more or less successful modus vivendi. And the first statement of it, tenet of it, is no one has the right to harm the Jew. So for 10 years, I've been saying, don't harm the Jew. And then I've been saying the Jew has no right to destroy our culture either. So it's a balanced thing I'm talking about here.
There's always a catch, isn't it?
Pardon me?
So there's always a catch.
Yeah, there's always a catch. And for 10 years... groups like the ADL have been calling me an anti-Semite because I'm saying don't harm the Jew. And they've been doing everything within their power to suppress my message and to turn me into a non-person. It's called dynamic silence.
Mm-hmm.
Jews practice this all the time. Okay, so the point I said at this point was, you guys succeeded. You succeeded in stifling my message, or you prevented my message from reaching this guy in Pittsburgh. And this guy in Pittsburgh took a gun and he went and killed those Jews because you are not allowing people to listen to my message, which is that no one has the right to harm the Jew. So what you're doing is bringing about the very thing you say you want to prevent by stifling any type of discussion. No type of discussion is acceptable. None whatsoever. Even if you say the same thing that a Jew has said, if you say it in a way they don't like, they will call you an anti-Semite. I've said this before. If you say the Jews are behind gay marriage, they call you an anti-Semite. If Amy Dean says it in Tikkun magazine, well, that just shows you how great Jews are. This is intolerable. And this is precisely the type of thing that the church could speak about openly in 1890 and can no longer talk about. Can't say anything.
And this might have something to do, I think you alluded to it, I think the fact, I've heard discussion that Vatican II was taken over by the German bishops, and of course Germany being a unique case because of, they were conquered in the Second World War and occupied and still occupied, both militarily and also psychologically, that now the church has been denied the grammar necessary to engage in dialogue with the Jews, in hopes of it coming not only to the modus vivendi, but also to the hope of converting them, which is the mission of the church, is to baptize all nations. It denies the essential mission of the Catholic Church itself. It destroys the church.
It does destroy the church because it undermines the fundamental message of the church, which is that baptism is necessary for salvation and that the mission of the church is to baptize all people. I mean, did St. Peter know this? St. Peter in the Acts of the Apostles goes to Jerusalem. The first thing he says is, you killed Christ. And it says the Jews were cut to the heart. And then the Jews said, well, what must we do to be saved? And Peter said, you have to be baptized. And 5,000 Jews were baptized that day. Now, that's it. That's it. That's the total message. It's in a nutshell. It's in the scripture. That's the only mission that the church, that's the only gospel the church can preach. If you start preaching dialogue, you're not preaching the gospel. Mm-hmm. You're preaching something else.
And yeah, and you know, I guess if it's not important for Jews to be baptized, then the logic is not important for Catholics to be baptized.
It's not important for anybody.
Yeah, right? Yeah. It's not nobody. Yeah, yeah.
That's the verb of evangelization. It calls into question the very foundation of the church, Christ's command, and the whole economy of salvation. I'm not the only guy who's talking this way. There are theologians now who are starting to see the ramification of this denial of the mission to the Jews.
And all this because of Auschwitz.
All because of Auschwitz. That's the Pope's testimony right there.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of like a slim reed historically to base Catholic theology on, because we go back 2,000 years.
Yes.
You know, and to base it on something that happened in 1980 or what 1944 or whatever it is, it's not, and it's that's a historical event that still needs to be evaluated.
It keeps changing. It keeps changing.
It keeps changing.
Yes, it's fundamentally changing.
And make it the foundation of Catholic theology. This is not so. So what happened here? Even with this kind of attempt on Ratzinger's part to square the circle, he got slapped down by the German theologians, the uppity German theologians. Cardinal Müller, just the former prefect of the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith under Pope Francis, a German himself, just did an article interview in the Tagespost in Germany, in which he just laid into the German theological establishment and said it's a disaster for the church. There's not one who really accepts church teaching. They got lots of money. They're kind of full of themselves. They don't talk to anybody but themselves, and it's a disaster for the church. Okay, so Ratzinger publishes this article, and one of these uppity German theologians by the name of Bönke, Herr Bönke, Herr Professor Dr. Bönke, that lays into to the Pope, or the Pope Emeritus, and says he's, first of all, backing away from Nostra Aetate. He's ignoring the suffering that the Jews had. And if he persists in this, he will lay to rest any idea that we had that Ratzinger was a great theologian. Now, how's that for an insult? How's that for an arrogant, insulting way of talking to the Pope? But that's just an indication of the status of theology in Germany. Now, that's okay. Everybody's got their problems. But the problem with German theologians is that they've inflicted their problems on the entire Catholic Church through Vatican II. And they are still acting as the cops, the political correctness cops when it comes to the Jewish question. And that, I think, what I covered in this article on Werner Heisenberg is the history of social engineering after World War II. I think that's what we have to trace this to.
This is particularly in Germany?
In Germany especially. I mean, it was ruthless. There's no question. And if you're not familiar with the story, it's going to appear in the January issue of Culture Wars. But the talk I gave in Bavaria, I said, who was the enemy of Germany in 1947? Was it the Soviet Union? Was it Stalin? Or was it Henry Morgenthau? Mm-hmm. Roosevelt, Secretary of the Treasury. Nobody talks about the Morgenthau Plan anymore. Everybody talks about the Marshall Plan, but before the Marshall Plan, there was a Morgenthau Plan. And the Morgenthau Plan, Morgenthau was a Jew. His assistant was Harry Dexter White, who was not only a Jew, but a Soviet agent in the government. And they concocted the Morgenthau Plan, which was basically to starve the German people to death. And that almost happened during the winter of 1947, which the Germans now refer to as Der Hungerwinter, 46-47. It got so bad that Cardinal Frings, Cardinal Archbishop of Cologne, announced from the pulpit that if you don't have enough to eat and you don't have a job, feel free to break into the nearest American warehouse and take whatever you need, because it's not theft if you're starving to death. He also said the same thing about coal. If there's a coal train out there and it's got coal in it and you don't have any coal to burn in your stove, take the coal from the train. It's not theft. He was the only guy in Germany who had the balls to stand up to the Jews who were trying to starve Germany to death. Okay, so June of 1947, General Marshall is invited to Harvard for an honorary degree. He gives a commencement address and he says, "Hey, our enemy is not the German people. Our enemy is hunger." And the new plan gets put into place, the Marshall Plan, which basically revives the economy and leads to the Wirtschaftswunder, and that leads to the Germany that we know today. Now, so Morgenthau's out in the cold, Harry Dexter White's out in the cold, but this doesn't mean that the Jewish plan of revenge ever stopped. It just continued war by other means. And the other means were psychology, and also the psychology was the basis for social engineering. And that's what happened to Germany. Every single magazine, every single newspaper, every single movie, every single radio broadcast, whatever, if you were going to do that, you had to get a license from a Jew from New York City by the name of David Mordecai Levy. And in order to do that, you had to write an essay about German guilt or something like that. This was total control over the flow of information. It was called actually the Office for Control of Information. And the Jews were in charge. And the Jews then launched into their campaign to destroy the moral fabric of the German people by doing what? Guess what they got involved
with? Sexual revolution?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And Wilhelm Reich, all of the Frankfurt School, the American Jewish Committee brought the Frankfurt School over to America, put them to work on the authoritarian personality project. As soon as the war ends, they all go back to Germany and they all become the social engineers that are going to restructure the German character. And one of the things they realize, this is in the, you know, two great books that I read as part of this, the Frankfurt School crowd realized the earlier you have sexual relations, the more democratic you end up being. I'm not making this up. And so guess what they did? They started sexualizing teenagers, and the result was that series of movies called Der Schulmädchen Report, softcore porn, 13 segments of the Schulmädchen Report, the schoolgirl report, where you got begins with scientific blah blah blah, and it ends up with TNA for 13 segments during the 1970s. This was an assault on the sexual morality of German teenagers with horrendous consequences.
Well, yeah, mission accomplished. You see, with the birth rates today, the demoralization of German society, yeah, soften them up for the Great Migration, yeah.
That's right. And now they feel that their back is to the wall, and there's a Merkel's going to leave because she just didn't understand the whole immigration as a weapon that's being used against them. And so she's out. But how are they going to deal with it? That's where we are right now. We have to raise the consciousness of everyone about the real history and the real story of what's going on right now.
It's a similar, I mean, not to a lesser degree, I guess, because America wasn't conquered and bombed back to the Stone Age. But, obviously, you've written books, Slaughter of Cities, The Libido Dominandi, the same type of tricks were played here with the American Jewish Committee working with the CIA and Hollywood to bring about the same process here in the United States in the post-war era.
Absolutely. Yeah. The same thing was going on here. The enemy was the Catholics. That's mm-hmm. who the enemy. They were the classic example of the authoritarian personality in the United States, and they bore the brunt of the social engineering here. And have you ever heard a bishop talk about this? No. Their parishes were destroyed. I asked Cardinal Kroll while he was alive. You just lost the MBS, Most Blessed Sacrament Parish, the biggest source of vocations in the diocese, Archdiocese of Philadelphia, and you just lost it because the black people drove all the white people out, and what are you going to do about it? And he looked at me and he said, "You can't tell people where to live."
Yeah.
Totally clueless about psychological warfare, about the manipulation of emigration. We suffered it before Europe suffered it. Mm-hmm. What do you think happened in Philadelphia and all of these big cities in the North and the East? It was contrived immigration, flooding the Irish neighborhoods, the ethnic neighborhoods of Philadelphia with black sharecroppers from North Carolina. It came from North Carolina, Philadelphia. If it's Chicago, they came from Mississippi. But it was the same people. The Ford Foundation was behind it. But we were the dumb goyim, the dumb Catholics looking there. It looked like black people. So it looked like a black versus white thing. I still can't convince the white boys who invited me to those shows that there were other people involved above those poor black sharecroppers. I taught them. I taught those ladies when I was a composition professor at Temple University. The black ladies would come in there and they sit in my class and they fall asleep immediately. Not because I'm not a brilliant speaker, it's because they've been working all day and it was night school. Yeah. And then that one of them woke up and told me the story of how she was pulling a plow in North Carolina. They didn't have a mule, so she had to pull the plow. These were the people that were brought up into Philadelphia by people like the Reverend Leon Sullivan, who was a stooge of the Ford Foundation. I show this. It's all in Slaughter of Cities. Mm-hmm. Verse, Slaughter of Cities. So now we have the same thing in Europe. And where is the church? Where is the church?
Well, it's a similar betrayal, same way the church had the interracial council, Catholic interracial council, and right. Also the their office on welfare and these things. They saw it as a progressive move, a humanitarian thing, and it was just sort of the zeitgeist of the age to be pro-integration. They didn't understand, or perhaps they were infiltrated by more malevolent forces, that there was a psychological warfare game being played, and they were destroying these ethnic parish, like Most Blessed Sacrament parish, which was the backbone of the church. It's this demographic power, which were they were able to elect politicians that could maintain the moral order. People like what's his name in Philadelphia,
Frank Rizzo.
Frank Rizzo, but who was the state senator who held up all the funding?
Oh, Martin Mullen.
Martin Mullen, so out of that parish, you get a Martin Mullen, then he was eventually more or less gerrymandered out through racial integration.
He held up the entire state budget of Pennsylvania because of birth control. The WASP elite wanted the government to pay for birth control because they wanted to solve the Negro question the way Margaret Sanger wanted to solve the Negro problem, mm-hmm. by having them take birth control and not breed anymore.
It's sort of a misanthropic view.
And the black ministers all went along with it. And it was a courageous soul like Martin Mullen who stood alone in the breach. And I mean alone in the breach there.
Mm-hmm.
The most hated man in Philadelphia in the 1960s.
Yeah, and you also write up in Slaughter Cities the fact that, the Office of Economic Opportunity under Sergeant Shriver actually gave almost $1 million to the Blackstone Rangers, a criminal gang, to create white flight. And so it's almost like they were like ISIS, or they were like proxy forces using to destabilize a region. Yeah.
Yeah, I just met Cynthia McKinney over Skype.
Oh, yeah, I listened to that interview. It was very, very, very good. Yeah.
There's a courageous lady. She was elected by the people of Georgia, and she thought she was supposed to represent them. Where do you come? Represent who? And so she shows up in her office, and the fax machine turns out the IPAC pledge. She's got to sign the IPAC pledge. She hasn't even been sworn in yet, and she's supposed to sign the IPAC pledge. Mm-hmm. Well, she refuses, and she's run out of town because IPAC gets Jew money behind her opponent, and that's the end of Cynthia McKinney.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, Cynthia, your people were proxy warriors long before we had the Mujahideen in Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
They were like the original proxy warriors in America. This has not dawned yet. This consciousness has not dawned yet in the mind of black people. You probably figured that out. Okay, we have made little steps forward. We did a show, two black guys, two white guys. I was one of the white guys in about the statue to Martin Luther King and Theodore Hesburgh that just got erected in South Bend. We had total unanimity here that the whole point of Martin Luther King coming to Chicago was to destroy Catholic ethnic neighborhoods. There was no segregation in Chicago. There were ethnic neighborhoods. And in the 1920s, if you were a Czech and you moved into a German neighborhood, or you were German and you moved into a Czech neighborhood, There was violence. Someone would throw rocks through your windows because you weren't part of that group. And then the whole civil rights template got imposed on that as a way of giving moral cogency to the fact that you were just engaging in ethnic cleansing, the ethnic cleansing of the Catholic population.
Excuse me. Now, in the you wrote a lot in Barry Metal about usury, of course. Usury. Usury is capitalism is state-sponsored usury. And this piece addresses usury directly. Can you give us what does it say about usury? What does usury do to the – what's the long-term trajectory of usury in a society? What does it lead to?
It leads to the concentration of wealth into fewer and fewer hands. And so you have a guy like Dan Gilbert now. Who is Dan Gilbert? I mean, he runs Detroit. He's got the Quicken Loans. It's usury. And that is the biggest business in Detroit. It's bigger than General Motors now. Now, this is going to have Dan Gilbert also owns casinos. He owns the casino in Cincinnati, and he's got one in, I think it's in Cleveland as well. And these casinos, Jewish casinos, are like vacuum cleaners that suck money out of the local economy into the coffers of the Jew, who then lends it to people. And even because the vacuum cleaner goes up five notches in its power once you add usury to gambling. That is a toxic combination. In the 1950s, it was illegal. Okay, both were illegal. There's a reason why these things are illegal, because they will wreck any economy by concentrating the wealth into fewer and fewer hands. And when you then the final emergence of the decriminalization of gambling and usury is a figure like Dan Gilbert or Sheldon Adelson, who has so much money he can buy any politician he wants.
They're not
as cheap as academics, but they're pretty cheap. And you have that kind of money.
I heard recently that Sheldon Adelson recently converted a former steel plant, Bethlehem Steel Plant in Pennsylvania, to a casino. So that's the new economy.
That is a symbolic gesture that's worth noting.
Deindustrialization, a usury and gambling, vice, right? Vice. Supplants.
Vice. All of these things are traditionally controlled by Jews, and they're active in them now. If you look into these so-called Indian casinos, you'll find that the Indians all have names like Goldberg and Eisenberg, and it's like right out of Blazing Saddles. Remember when Mel
the paddle?
He calls it hold on, Zygazunt, he says. So we have these Jewish Indians running casinos.
And that was that scandal with Abramoff, right?
That's right. Abramoff and Ralph Reed. Now, this shows you what a dumb goy I was, because I was working with Ralph Reed back then in the 90s when there was the great Catholic Evangelical Alliance and we were going to ban abortion or something like that, until I realized, hey, these guys are all working for the Zionists. It's all a Zionist operation and nothing's going to happen here.
Now, this piece mentions that, you know, obviously usury, how usury concentrates power, particularly in the hands of Jewish finance, who this article points, like in the case of France, makes the comparison where the revolution in France destroyed the patrimony of the Catholic Church, the 4 billion francs that it controlled. But this 4 billion francs was dispersed throughout the country and created a whole welfare system, like a sustainable society. But then shoot ahead 100 years, and there's 60 billion francs that are controlled by a few Jewish banking families, and no one seems to look askance at that. Same situation today, this massive wealth. People will say, well, look, the church is so wealthy. Why is it so rich and these things? But it pales in comparison to something like the wealth that has been amassed by something like the Rothschild dynasty.
Well, the amount is deceptive. That's not really the issue. If you look at Cobbett's History of the Church of the Reformation in England, that church wealth was put to the use for the common people. There were hospitals, there were purgatory societies, there were all sorts of things where the church would put you up if you were in a hard way, or be a charitable organization, or allow you to graze your sheep on their property. This all changed with the Reformation, which was basically the theft of church property, but also the privatization of what was property that was being used for the common good.
This is enclosures?
Enclosures, all this type of stuff. And you created overnight in England a class of people who could not earn their living by any means at all anymore. And they became robbers. And they were robbers and vagabonds and whatever you want to call them up until the Industrial Revolution when they became wage slaves.
Well, they didn't have unpaid internships back then.
They didn't have what?
Unpaid internships.
No.
But then, this was the rise of pauperism in England was associated with enclosure movement, also the English Reformation, the destruction of church property.
Yes, there is no theological justification whatsoever for the English Reformation. It was pure theft, nothing but theft of church property, and then a few Anglican clergymen trying to sprinkle holy water on it after the fact.
Mm-hmm.
It was theft. That's all it was. And the wealth went into the hands of a few people, and the majority suffered impoverishment because of that theft.
Mm-hmm.
It was a purgatory society, was a plot of land where you were allowed to graze your sheep on that land if you prayed for the soul of the man who owned the property. That was putting that land to productive use, and everyone benefited from that. That was all destroyed by the Reformation.
Yes, and I guess the upstart aristocracy had their teeth sunk deep in the hide of Mother Church, then weren't going to be ripped off with a sermon. I'm paraphrasing, but I think that's how it goes.
That's right, the famous line by Orange Tawney.
Yeah. A great quote. Okay, there's a problem here. There's a question. Still, the question persists. And, I was looking at some of the solutions that were suggested in the article itself and looking at the composition of today's society, particularly American society, being a, being a polyglot, multi-religious society, these things. There isn't there's no longer really a Christian consciousness or a Catholic consciousness that you can appeal to create this consciousness and address the problem effectively. Because here, they say the problem is that in the wake of the revolution, the French Revolution, you had civil rights or civil equality granted to Jews, whereas in the past, there were these exclusion laws. They were treated differently. They were acknowledged that they were an alien race or people who didn't play by the same Christian rules. And that presumes a Christian society, sort of an integral Christian society in existence that doesn't really exist today in America. Or anywhere off I can find, but you could see in that context, people would be aware. Says, well, they're different, so they got to play, but they don't play by the same rules, so we can't grant them the same rights. But and by today's understanding, that would be perceived as being illiberal and brutal. Because how would you implement such things as redistributing properties or kicking them out, these things. This would be inherently brutal. So I don't know if those remedies are even something we can even consider, even get close to now, other than general consciousness, to hope that we could, hope to alter or curb behavior of some of these oligarchs. What I'm trying to get at is
we can't see a solution. Can't see a solution, and when you can't see a solution, then people tend to become violent.
Yeah, like shooting.
I think we saw in France was this type of violence.
Mm-hmm.
France now has a history of violence because of the French Revolution. And so what we saw was a mini revolution just this past week. And I don't know whether you were watching the reports of the yellow vests in Paris. There's a man there, the tear gas is flying, there are rocks going back and forth. And the BBC commentator is trying to give some type of description of what's going on. And this guy in a yellow vest comes up to the camera and he says, Macron, pute de juif, the Macron, the whore of the Jews.
Well, he is a Rothschild guy.
And the BBC guy says, oh, I'm sorry about that. Sorry. Well, wait a minute. This is the Vox Populi. This is the Vox Populi. And it's part of the, obviously, it's part of the whole story that is being suppressed here.
Mm-hmm.
The people in these demonstrations understand that Macron is working for the Jews, for the Jewish oligarchs. And that is not a healthy situation. And it led to a revolution. And now he's trying to back away from it by raising the wages. Well, thank you. thank you for, you're admitting that you were screwing us all now. And maybe it will save him. Maybe it'll save his presidency. I don't know. There were demonstrations again this week. But I'm saying that that is a revolutionary change where the whole Jewish participation in it was suppressed, completely suppressed. And so what you're saying, when you completely suppress something, you have something analogous to the Pittsburgh shooting.
Mm-hmm.
Someone will take and say, it's hopeless. There's no point talking anymore. I'm getting a gun. And in America, everybody is individually a revolutionary. In France, they can actually cooperate with each other and have a political movement. You can't have that here in the United States. Okay, but you can have it over there. I'm proposing something that is not violent, but is something that the church could lead if it stopped, if it will start proclaiming the gospel again. It is not proclaiming the gospel. And as a result, it opens the field to the violent people who at a certain point they feel the situation is hopeless and they become violent.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's a revolution on the streets in France or whether it's a lone gunman here in Pittsburgh, this is the type of thing that's going to be happening more and more frequently unless the church gets out in front of this situation.
They definitely have to let people express themselves and communicate and not, you know, try to suppress free speech, because it is going to manifest itself in violence if people don't have any relief valve for this stuff. It's like a pressure cooker, but you need some sort of, you know, and you can't have any dialogue or discussion about things, but that's all I think, that's how the oligarchs prefer it. They just want to, you know, shut everything down and control the dialogue and keep everything within a very narrow scope, so they can control, you know,
yeah,
the narrative.
Yeah, there are both sides of the Jewish revolutionary spirit prefer violence. The revolutionaries like Karl Marx prefer violence, so they prefer repression because it creates violence because it will bring about revolution. And on the other side of the coin, I think the oligarchs prefer violence too because it allows them to crack down. And I think that's why this is a dog whistle here, Jewish dog whistle, George Soros.
Yes.
You can't say George Soros now without being accused of being an anti-Semite. I'm sorry. But anyway, that's the way it is right now. It shows you how draconian this speech control is. But this is why George Soros promotes Black Lives Matter.
Mm-hmm.
He likes racial violence. He's promoting racial violence. The Jews promoted racial violence ever since the Leo Frank case, ever since the founding of the Anti-Defamation League. The Jews have been using black people as the avant-garde of their revolution. They've been using them as proxy warriors to basically destroy the social order in the United States. And I think now black people like Cynthia McKinney are starting to wake up to that fact.
This is why they promoted jazz, now they promote rap.
Yeah.
You know, first with Chess Records and then Death Row Records, right? There's a manipulation of the blacks, also manipulation of the whites, because you mentioned, you know, the white guys, right? The sort of white identity movement we're seeing, which is sort of a negative identity in reaction to basically all this.
One of the greatest victories of the social engineers was to convince Catholic ethnics, Poles, Italians, and Irishmen to call themselves white.
Mm-hmm.
That was a great victory, because once you declare yourself white, you have no rights. You're ipso facto guilty. And that's what happened when the Catholic ethnics were driven out of their neighborhoods. They were Irish in North Philadelphia. When they got to the suburbs, they became white. And once you're white, you have no control over who you are, because there's no content to that statement. You don't speak white. Actually, I did a show with a lady, one of the white guys, nice guy, Rams Paul. He's got a Finnish lady. I said, Finland. I said, what language do you speak? She says, I speak a white language. What do you mean a white language? This is what happened, like across the whole Scandinavian world right now. Protestantism has evaporated, and the vacuum is now being filled by white identity.
Yeah, you said that a white guy is a Protestant doesn't go to church anymore, right?
That's right. That's what it is.
And they're looking to be Thor or something, right?
Yeah, and they have – actually, there are plenty of – like, isn't that Game of Thrones? Isn't that what that's pandering to? You know, all these white guys sitting in their parents' basement because they can't get a job. All they can get is an unpaid internship, and they got debt. But they can watch these, play these Viking video games or something like that, and live out this fantasy. No reality whatsoever here.
Well, I mean, I have a lot of sympathy for their plight. It's a tough world out there, particularly now for men. For women, too, but women are, in the same way, women are being used as sort of the avant-garde, you know, to undermine male authority. It's what feminism was all about. But the idea, you know, obviously with, there was a time when a man could go out, he was healthy and he had a work ethic, he could earn a wage, support a family, then he would, then in return, get the loyalty, admiration of his family, and he was king in his home, and there's a broad respect for that. But, for, you know, after 40, 50 years of total of denigration, they seem partly... Well, I think we've done shows about how black male authority were smashed, more so, actually. So there's a whole dimension to this. You know, this isn't a simple thing to talk about. It's not a simple issue. It's very complex. But when they talk, I guess they would say, when they say white, they're talking about European identity. And, you know, America is a transplanted European civilization with certain accents and these things. And I do agree with you that given the context of America, what America is, and I'm still trying to figure out what the project is, I think it's free... It's Judeo-Masonic from the beginning, so there's a problem there, me being a Catholic, with identifying with the American project. Is there something fundamentally incompatible with America with being a Catholic, I think, and that's healthy. Because, the idea that, you write about this. There was a time when you had these ethnic neighborhoods, these enclaves, these regions, these things. Absent social engineering, these societies probably would have done well, probably would have integrated in a way that social engineers wanted. But nevertheless, with these ethnic neighborhoods, their ethnic consciousness would have been preserved, their identity would be there. But this was in conflict with the agenda of the elite, the war planners. This is Henry Luce, the American century. They want to homogenize America. About the empire. In order to have an empire, you have to homogenize. It seems like they're trying to homogenize the entire globe now. This is a broad, project here. So they're kind of reacting to this. So the problem with this is, and this is where something we're reading your books has helped me kind of understand this, kind of understand their plight, and their argument is they don't understand the grammar behind this, which is that social engineering aspect of how they were turned into white folk.
No, they don't.
Yeah.
They don't. So I said, please do not internalize the commands of your oppressors.
Mm-hmm.
Every time you say you're white, there is rejoicing in the social engineering establishment, because you have basically taken on an alien identity that has no content. It has no content. I've been back and forth in the comment box on YouTube, with over and over and over again trying to say something like this.
Yeah.
And it's new. It's a new concept, so it takes a while before some new type of concept sinks in. But I just said, they keep confusing race, by which they mean some type of physical characteristic like skin color and something mm-hmm. like that, with ethnicity. They're completely different things.
Mm-hmm.
I said Tanzania is a country that has 76 different ethnic groups. Well, they all look the same. I mean, maybe for me, they're all black.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
They all look the same to me. I don't see any physical distinguishing characteristics between these groups. The only thing that distinguishes these people is the language that they speak. There are 76 different languages. Language is the criterion for ethnic identity, not skin color. It's irrelevant. And the United States is an exception to this rule anyway, because it's all immigrants. And I said the triple melting pot, everybody's... After three generations, you're Catholic, Protestant, or Jew, or you don't have an identity. They're the three identities, and it's based on. And they keep saying, well, what about? Well, that's what it is. That's what it is. You're barking up the wrong tree if you're trying to find some type of explanation in biology for behavior. It doesn't work.
And Chris, a good example of being tricked into something, and you've commented on this, would be like Charlottesville.
Yes.
Where they led to this, of course, they're protesting. They got permits. They're protesting this, the iconoclasts and taking down these Confederate statues. They're being baited with that issue. But, what happened there? You had, the carpetbagger government in Charlottesville set them up.
And, they did.
Yeah. And they thought they could play by the same rules as the civil rights movement or something. You made a comment recently about that. The Operation Rescue fell in the same trap back in the 80s, where they could play by the same rules. The problem is the oligarchs wanted the civil rights establishment or these official, you know, to succeed for their own reason. They didn't want Operation Rescue. They want abortion, nor do they want these white folks to succeed at Charlottesville. So they're not going to be given the same courtesy in the media or anything.
Or the same rights. I mean, yeah. These people all felt they had First Amendment rights to assemble and express their grievances. Well, you don't. I'm sorry, but this is a kind of naive. You mean you don't believe in the tooth fairy? It's like, well, what? This is kind of naive Americanism here. That everybody has the same rights under the law. This is preposterous. If you're Jeffrey Epstein, you don't go to jail. You get a sweetheart deal because you had Alan Dershowitz on the Lolita Express.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Alan Dershowitz, if he were a Catholic priest, he'd be in jail right now. But he happens to be a lawyer, a Jewish lawyer from Harvard, and so he can just dominate the system. He can game the system.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody's going to say anything about it. So don't give your friends spears and tell them to charge the machine gun nest.
Yeah.
It's going to work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I know we're running short on time or over past an hour. What's the Catholic response to all this, to the turmoil that we're seeing in American society and Western civilization in general? Because I look at something like Christendom and what it kind of established, this broad Catholic faith, which incorporated different ethnicities, generally peacefully.
And, that's right.
Something like the Habsburg Empire and these things, where these things weren't perfect situations, but compared to what succeeded them, they're far superior, I think. So,
no, the Catholic Church did have a modus vivendi that was extraordinarily successful, and it was just destroyed, deliberately destroyed by the Masonic forces of World War I and so on and so forth. The Catholics believe in logos. They believe that God is logos, which means they believe in consciousness. Everything begins with consciousness. And so the first item on the agenda is to get the Catholic Church, the hierarchy, please abandon this failed experiment called Catholic-Jewish dialogue. It failed. By your own estimation, it failed. Just read your own documents. It failed. It cannot succeed. And let's get back to start preaching the gospel. And that way you will not inhibit the emergence of this new consciousness in places like Germany, where it's going to emerge whether you like it or not. So you can either come up and have a contribution to this discussion, or you can just demonize everybody as a pawn of the Jews and provoke the very violence that you say you don't want to have.
Okay. Anything else, Dr. Jones? I think you usually have you for an hour. I want to be respectful of your time.
So. Oh, it's always a pleasure, Tim. Always a pleasure to be on your show.
Well, thank you for coming back on the show. Of course, that's Dr. E. Michael Jones, the editor of Culture Wars magazines, culturewars.com, author of several books. Of course, the most recent, the one coming out, I guess, early next year, perhaps, is the Logos of History and History of Logos, right? Is that the working title?
Yes.
Okay, of course, you can get your books either at Amazon or directly at Culture Wars, preferably, right?
Yes.
So, okay, well, listen, I want thanks for coming on, and I will wish you a Merry Christmas and Happy New Year.
Same to you, Tim.
Good night. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.